Hello and welcome to the Right to Vulnerable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
And my name's Jazza and I, as Member of Parliament for absolutely nowhere, can neither confirm nor deny whether or not I would be happy to serve as Prime Minister in a potential caretaker government after the toppling of Boris Johnson in a no-confidence vote. Neither confirm nor deny. I voted to remain. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk sometimes about politics, social issues and current events. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello. I don't think you actually have to be an MP to be Prime Minister. Some people are discussing this on Twitter and it's purely a conventional thing. And we seem to be tearing up a lot of conventions these days. So I don't think your lack of having a seat in Parliament is any barrier to you becoming Prime Minister.
That is a very exciting piece of information you've just told me, Jimmy. Let me just alert the relevant individuals and we'll see what happens in the next few days.
I am enjoying the fact that I think it was Ken Clark, I don't know if Harriet Harman has said a similar thing, but he was like, I would be Prime Minister if you want me to do it.
Yeah,
definitely do it.
If you needed me to. The man who's run for the Conservative leadership more times than you can shake a stick at. And clearly does. I'd love Ken Clark to be Prime Minister.
That's because he's a terrible Ramona, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's also totally a cuddly old man.
Is he too old to be Prime Minister?
Isn't that the point? Isn't that one of the reasons that Jo Swinson put forward Harriet Harman and Ken Clark forward? Because, well, first of all, they're obviously both hardcore Remainers. And also, wasn't it like, they are mother and father of the House, the two oldest MPs of their respective sexes. And therefore they won't have a stake in sticking around too long, I think is basically what her argument was, right?
Well, yeah, worst comes to worst, they will just die in office because they're getting towards that age.
Yeah, well, not so much Harriet Harman. She's in like... But Ken Clark is really bloody old. Bless him. We like him, though.
He's almost 80, isn't he? I could have looked this up, but...
Ken...
It's much more fun just to blag it and then... Or maybe you could look it up in the background.
He was born in 1940. So, yeah.
Oh, my God.
So, he is 79.
There you go.
Yeah, wowzers.
Okay, what are we going to be talking about, aside from Ken Clark's age?
Well, all of that stuff about Brexit, innit? That's our thing. That's our shtick. We hang the whole podcast on it. Jeremy Corbyn, who is the leader of the British opposition in Parliament, of the Labour Party, he has written a public letter to all of the other opposition parties, everybody who isn't a Conservative, saying, hey guys, how about we take down Boris Johnson and then make me Prime Minister, and then I promise that I'll extend Article 50, have a general election, and then have a second referendum with Remain on the ballot. And people are like, well, we are getting a little bit desperate. But Jo Swinson, our Jo, gotta love her. She's gone, maybe not, mate. Maybe we should probably have a non-divisive figure as part of a quote-unquote unity government. We'll have a little bit of a chat about that, the consequences of it, and how. And Jimmy obviously is going to speak for the 52%.
Yes, for the majority, you actually won the referendum.
Yeah,
not to rub it in.
No majority, it's about 33% of the population. Anyway, go on.
Yes, so second up, we are going to be talking about Hong Kong, and I'm not going to pretend that I can introduce this topic or pricey it properly, so I'm going to hand it straight back to you. What is happening in Hong Kong,
Jazza? Oh, you coward. So Hong Kong, over the last few years, has had a little bit of a strong kind of like civil rights movement around democratization of the self-administering region, which is part of China. So obviously Hong Kong was part of the British Empire until it was handed back as part of a lease, which is kind of hilarious. We leased it for 99 years and then gave it back to China in 1997. Since then, Hong Kong has been self-governing, but hasn't had full democracy. Only part of the legislature is actually elected by the people, and then the rest are kind of like appointed by Hong Kongese, by business, by kind of like political parties, and also by Beijing, the central Chinese Communist Party, governed mainland China. There was meant to be, as part of the handover from Britain to China, there was meant to be kind of like more democratization, like guaranteed in the part of Hong Kong for Hong Kongese, and that was meant to happen in 2014 and 15, and they said, lol, no, part of China now. And since then, there's been kind of like a long string of protests. The most recent ones are around a specific piece of legislation about China being able to request extraditions from Hong Kong, not just of Hong Kongese citizens, but of foreign nationals as well. And a lot of people are saying that this is a big problem when it comes to the sovereignty of Hong Kong and of the control that the Chinese Communist Party, based in Beijing, has over the traditionally more free island. So we're going to give a little bit of context to that, and also we're going to talk about Mulan, the live action Disney remake.
I totally forgot that I sent you that link. So basically, because the main actress in Mulan, yeah, this is a live action version, has sort of tweeted her support for the police in Hong Kong and for the anticipated and ongoing crackdown.
Just to get you there, she hasn't tweeted, she posted on Weibo.
Oh, sorry. That's the equivalent of Facebook, is it, in China?
It's kind of like it's often simplified as like the Twitter of China, kind of like a hybrid of Twitter and Facebook, really.
Right, and so because she's tweeted that, people on Twitter are trying to organise, actual Twitter this time, are trying to organise a boycott of the Mulan film. I thought the original was quite good, as far as I remember it. It's obviously been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, but, make a man out of you. It's quite good.
There are some good tunes in it.
Really great tunes.
It has a strong feminist message.
But also, she is the only Disney princess, is our Mulan, to have committed mass genocide by causing an avalanche that kills thousands of soldiers. Anyway, what's our third topic going to be, Jimmy?
Our third topic, which is not in my notes because we only just changed it, is going to be... I've actually forgotten... This is really bad.
Aaron Banks has threatened to kill Greta Thunberg with weather.
Okay, I do remember this. So Aaron Banks, who's the kind of the sugar daddy of Nigel Farage, I think it's fair to say, and also the funder of Leave.eu and general funder of sort of Leave Brexity activities, I think it's fair to say, made a joke about Greta Thunberg, who's the environmental activist who sort of was at the head of a lot of these Extinction Rebellion type protests, is crossing over in a boat to attend the UN headquarters in New York in order to address, you know, various bigwigs. And because she's crossing in a boat, Aaron Banks decided to tweet something along the lines of, you know, freak accidents happen at sea all the time, the implication being that, you know, this 16-year-old girl might die, and that is apparently funny to Aaron Banks.
Yeah,
that's a fair summary, really.
Yeah, hilarious. And Caroline Lucas, the MP from the Green Party, has said that she's complained about him to Twitter, and I wouldn't be mad if Aaron Banks got taken off.
Some of the stuff he says is occasionally entertaining, but I only really see him when other people angrily retweet him going, this is outrageous.
Mm-hmm. It's mainly him and Julie Hartley Brewer kind of like retweeting each other into some kind of like a circle jerk.
Well, Julia Hartley Brewer, who's she's an LBC journalist, I think.
Yeah, also The Mail.
Yeah, formerly of The Mail,
yes.
Maybe. Yeah, but she tweeted that she retweeted a video of Greta Thunberg in her boat and said, "Oh, I've just booked flights to some exotic location and I feel absolutely no guilt about it," which was another hilarious joke. So yeah. there's a lot of jokes going on.
This is one of the problems. We went to that kind of alternative comedy night, by the way, which is now on the BBC, and we're like, it's very awkward seeing us in the audience of that show.
When but you I say just... we, I wasn't actually there. It was you.
Oh no, it's me and some others. It's probably a good job you weren't there now. And the right wing just aren't as funny. I just don't think that they are. And that's fine.
Oh, that's a very contentious remark. Should we leave discussing that until we actually get around to that topic?
Oh, exciting. I can't wait.
Can't wait. All right, let's play some music, do the usual thing, and get back to talking about Brexit, the most important thing in the universe.
Oh, it is.
Hi there. If you're enjoying The Right Dishonourable, and we hope you are, there are various ways that you can support the show. Probably the easiest way is to go to twitter.com/rightdishonour, follow us there, send us any feedback you have, what you think we might be able to improve about the show, what you're liking about the show, all that sort of stuff. If you want to send us a bit of money, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. That's just a standard Patreon account, so I'm sure most of you know how that works. As always, we'd like to thank our current patrons, David Warner, Emerson Sparks, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support, and hopefully more people will be joining you very soon.
Is it reasonable, Jimmy, for Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, to assume that he should be the Prime Minister of any caretaker government that were to overthrow Boris Johnson and so that they are able to kind of like extend Article 50 and seek some changes to Brexit?
Well, on the one hand, he is the leader of the opposition, and when a government falls, it is sort of conventional that the leader of the opposition has the first crack at trying to form another government. And he is also, whatever else you say about him, the leader of the largest grouping in Parliament, other than the Conservatives. Mm-hmm. Although the loyalty that Labour MPs have towards Jeremy Corbyn is not as secure as it might be, let's say. So on those grounds, yes. But I think the entire shtick of the Government of National Unity, or the GNU, as people have insisted on abbreviating
it. Oh no, they haven't, have they? That's horrific.
Yeah, so Stephen Bush from the New Statesman is a particular offender in this regard.
Let's just call it just GNU.
GNU. I think GNU is like an operating system, like a Unix-style operating system. So it's just throwing me in. Just fewer acronyms, people. They don't need to exist.
Yes.
Anyway. Diversion aside, the thing is about this government of national unity is that it's supposed to be coming together basically just to get an extension on Brexit, in, you know, the theory being that we can hold a referendum, remain versus no deal, on the grounds that, you know, no kind of deal is really being put forward by the Tories at this point, so those are really the only two options on the table. And it doesn't, given those circumstances, it seems more appropriate, I think, to find a less divisive figure, or at least somebody who actually doesn't really have any interest in being Prime Minister for, like, a long time. Temporary Prime Ministers, you know, Prime Ministers are always temporary by their very nature, but just having someone who literally goes in just to do this one task and then quits and has no intention of, like, forming a government in the long term, that to me makes a lot more sense, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't make... Like, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn wants to be Prime Minister, or at least his team do. And he... Literally, it's someone to be Prime Minister for, like, a day, isn't it, really? Or, like, a couple of days, for them to be able to pass the relevant legislation that is, like, we're going to extend Article... There's 3 points, right? There's the extension of Article 50, and then there's kind of a disagreement about the order of general election and second referendum. Those are kind of, like, the three things that all of the opposition MPs desire. There was a really... the Lib Dems have been, oh my god, slated by all of the Labourites on my Twitter feed over the last few days, because they're like, oh, you're happy to get into bed with the Tories for 5 years, but you're not happy to get in bed with Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, I just think that in a very Lib Demi way, our Jo Swinson, she's just being very sensible. And she lays it out in, like, she writes, like, a counter letter to Jeremy Corbyn. Can I just say, it's so odd that all of these letters are being kind of, like, posted to Twitter, and this isn't kind of something that's been hashed out. I feel like this should have been hashed out, like, behind closed doors somewhere, and there should have been some kind of coordination away from Twitter, frankly. But anyway.
Well, presumably it is being, to some degree. The letters are kind of just press releases explaining what's going on.
Then call it press release. Why do you have to use the posh paper and put a, like, parliamentary header on it? It's very strange.
Because it seems fancy and official.
It does seem fancy and official, but it seems less fancy and official when it's cropped into two images at the bottom of a tweet. But Jo Swinson,
this is just an aesthetic complaint from your point of view, rather than anything else.
You see right through me. But Jo Swinson does end up explaining that to her knowledge, I believe they will need 8 Conservatives to come over and kind of, like, support this government of national unity, and there aren't enough Conservatives who will back Corbyn as the head of that government for this plan to reliably work. I believe Jo Swinson counted 7, and they need at least 8. And so, like, it is possible that you'll get over 8 when, like, push comes to shove, but she wants there to be someone who is not going to scare off all of those Conservatives, because they have such a toxicity surrounding Jeremy Corbyn. And to me, that makes sense, and her desire to kind of have a plan that actually works, rather than just be Prime Minister for the sake of being Prime Minister. If you really want Jeremy, you can be Prime Minister when you win the next election. Like, that's fine. The government of national unity thing, I don't think is an appropriate thing for someone who is already vying to be Prime Minister. That, I don't think it's an appropriate thing for them to chase.
So, other than Labour and the Lib Dems, who are a sort of back a government of national unity, but not necessarily with Corbyn at the head of it, and some rebel Tories, you've also got the Greens, the SNP, and Plaid Cymru, who've all said that they would back Cymru, sorry.
Plaid Cymru, also, you English bastard.
Okay, fine. you've got those three parties that are basically saying that they would back Jeremy Corbyn as a caretaker PM, you know, as given that that's the option that has been mooted by Labour so far. But there does seem to be a more general scepticism about whether, even if all of these various parties came together and you had some Tory rebels, there seems to be some scepticism from pundits that you'd still have the numbers, basically. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, potentially if you're only a couple of people over the line, it does sort of look as though it could risk collapse at any moment, really.
But that is kind of the point. It's expecting to collapse at any moment, but it's people signing up for those three things, kind of before anything's even formed, which is why I find it really weird that it's being hashed out in public. Like, these things need to be cemented in order for it to work. And also, there's so little time to be able to do it. It literally has to be done, like, the day after they come back from their holidays. Which, why is nobody talking about how fucking ridiculous it is that the MPs are still on holiday when we're... Oh, anyway.
How... I think people are mentioning that and how absurd it is. I think people are bringing that up. I will say that the other way of doing this, and that there was a column posted in the Times today. We're recording this on Saturday, the 17th of August, and it basically said that rather than forming a government of national unity, it makes more sense to sort of rehash what Yvette Cooper tried to do before the March deadline, and actually legislate to force the Prime Minister to whoever is Prime Minister at that point, whether it's Boris Johnson or whoever else, to seek an extension with the EU, on the assumption that the EU would probably grant an extension. Mm-hmm. If a British Prime Minister asked.
Yeah, we keep on forgetting that there is a third party in this, don't we? And that is the block of countries that we're looking to leave. Like, all of that, a lot of this is contingent on them actually being nice to us. And I wouldn't be surprised if, especially as we go, because they have a new parliament and a new commissioner and a new everything after the 31st of October. It's going to be all changed there, and I can imagine things not being as easy on our end.
But isn't it the Council of Ministers, i.e. ministers from each of the member states, who actually make the decision on this? rather than the Parliament.
Yes, but that also potentially changes.
I mean, in theory, any one member state of the 20 of the remaining 27 could actually veto our request for an extension. They could say no, we're just going to force you out because this is ridiculous. But it does seem to be assumed that if we asked for an extension, we would be given one. I don't know if that is a safe assumption, but that seems to be the working principle at this point.
I feel like in general there's good faith there still, right? Like, there's an understanding that the crazy Brexiters are not necessarily representative of the rest of the country, and they don't want to fuck over 48% of the nation. As a representative for the 52%, What do you think about these efforts? Because you don't want there to be a no deal. You think no deal is bad, but what if there were kind of like an opportunity? It would probably be something like Maysdale, but what if the opportunity arose of the public being able to vote for Theresa May's deal or the deal alongside remaining and dropping out with no deal?
I mean, that doesn't really seem to be the plan at the moment. I don't know, actually. I'm opposed to a second referendum for reasons we previously discussed. Because I just think that... I mean, this sounds as though I'm afraid that Remain would actually win. And in some ways, I think Remain would actually stand a good chance of winning. But it does seem to me to be a bit of a breach of trust, really, when... The original referendum was held on the basis of we will implement what you decide, mm-hmm. And yes, there are some records of various vote leave figures sort of discussing the possibility of a second referendum. Although, as I think in Tim Shipman's book, it mentions that that was discussed early on and then it was dropped and it wasn't really spoken about again, at least by the vote leave campaign. Mm. So I'm kind of opposed to a second referendum on that basis. But if there was a second referendum, I do think it would make sense to actually include effectively what would be the withdrawal agreement on that particular ballot.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm very sceptical that this is... I think the most likely resolution to all this is that actually we will leave with no deal. I think
these efforts are going to fail?
Yeah, well, I think that the Dominic Cummings plan, that's Boris Johnson's chief of staff, to actually but basically make it so that if Boris Johnson loses a vote of no confidence, which may well happen in September, to schedule, to play for time and then eventually schedule an election for after October the 31st, which is when we are scheduled to leave. I think from reading around the subject, that actually seems like a fairly sound plan in terms of actually achieving that outcome. You could argue about, you know, the ethics of and the constitutional propriety of doing that, but I think it will work, basically. So that, to me, seems like the most likely option in terms of the end to all of this.
But how does this make you feel?
I'd have preferred to leave via some sort of agreement, and you know, I'd preferred there to be more continuity between us leaving the EU. Well, yeah, just in the process of us leaving the EU, I think some kind of transition arrangement and sort of winding down of links makes more sense. And I do realise there are some compromises in that deviate from the clean Brexit that some people want, but it seemed to make more sense to me. So I'm not overjoyed by the prospect of no deal, but it does fulfil the referendum mandate. I think these arguments that there was no mandate for no deal don't really make any sense. We voted to leave the EU. As people have said, the actual construction, the actual what that looks like was effectively handed back to politicians, but I don't think that precluded no deal. I think it ran the gamut between some sort of deal that actually still left us, you know, on the periphery of the EU, and no deal at all, you know, a clean Brexit, as it were.
Ugh, clean Brexit. It's a dirty Brexit. Dirty, filthy Brexit.
yeah, I guess you could... Well, you know, it makes us the most independent and sovereign in the sense of being in control of things.
Oh, yeah, great, but it also means that we're not going to be able to buy any yoghurt.
I think those fears are overstated. And I think the thing is, if we actually do leave on no deal, it's not going to be as chaotic as the worst premonitions of Remainers. And I think, I mean, this seems to have been a kind of a risk that hasn't really been fully accounted for in Remainers' mind. If we leave, there will be, you know, potentially damage to the currency, and there will be disruption and that sort of thing. There's the risk that some people will lose their jobs. I think all of that is definitely true. But if it's not actual chaos, if actually life generally continues as before, albeit maybe the cost of living actually goes up because of the devaluation of the pound or whatever, then people are going to see, you know, going to see all of the warnings of Remainers as fundamentally silly. And I know that the whole idea behind this, the no deal rhetoric, was to try and encourage people not to go down this route. But I think if we leave with no deal, that kind of rhetoric will have backfired ultimately, and I think it will have undermined the credibility of the Remainers, who I suppose will become the rejoiners at that stage.
Yeah, I still don't know how I'm going to feel about that if it comes to us actually leaving and then being a rejoiner. I think it completely depends on what terms we end up rejoining, because I think we had actually well, you've heard me say this and it's a bit of rhetoric, but like, we had the best possible deal for the UK in the position that we're currently in, and we're pooping it down the toilet. Would you like to ask me anything about Hong Kong?
Before we move on, I just want to run one other thing past you. The Caroline Great. Lucas.
Oh yes,
Caroline Lucas, the Green MP we mentioned before, mooted this idea of an all-female cabinet to try on the basis that women are allegedly slightly more conciliatory, more cooperative than their male counterparts. And I saw, I looked into this claim, and I think it's actually, from what I could find, the actual research indicates that men and women are roughly as cooperative as one another, although it's slightly different in different contexts. But there was also apparently some parliamentary research which concluded that female politicians, at least, female British politicians, were more cooperative than their male counterparts,
mm-hmm.
which I could believe. I mean, it seems sort of plausible. I could believe it even given that other research I just cited. What do you think about it?
I think it's a little bit of a silly thing to suggest, to be completely honest. Women voted for Brexit too. And there are women across, like, obviously there are fewer women on the Conservative benches, but there are women across all of the benches. I think that, I feel like it was a bit of a... It was trying to achieve what kind of, like, Joe Swinson was suggesting, in terms of there being kind of like a some kind of a caretaker. And it would be kind of like a... Like, I'm also not sure I buy that just because you're a woman, you're going to be, especially in politics, I don't buy that you're necessarily going to be more likely to compromise, especially when we see the wonders of the two Conservative Prime Minister women that we've had. I don't think either of them have really been the epitome of working across party lines and being able to cooperate.
That is very fair.
Yeah.
What do you make of the backlash against this letter from people on the left and Remainers when people started noticing that all of the women were white in Caroline Lucas's proposed cabinet?
I mean, it would probably, if you are looking for more diversity in like a proposed cabinet, then maybe think about diversity along lines other than gender. I mean, we do currently
have... She was looking for less diversity.
All the men
to be ruled out.
Yeah, that's fair. And also kind of like, I don't know, like maybe she's kind of got an outdated view of feminism. I don't know her personally, obviously.
Do you not chat her?
No, funnily enough. Like it's interesting to go from, like, right now, despite the fact that they are all nut jobs, as I said in last in the last episode, we do have like ethnically speaking the most diverse cabinet that we've ever had, and to then kind of like for Caroline Lucas to be really kind of tone deaf in that, I think is quite surprising. But oh well.
Well, also ideologically, it wasn't diverse at all. I mean, all of the proposed members of this female cabinet would have been Remainers, which I just thought you'd have wanted some buy-in from some of the more moderate leavers in Parliament, female or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if you're trying to achieve a consensus that's going to be acceptable to most people, you know, by definition, you'd have wanted some leavers in there if you could get them.
Yeah, exactly. Or hashtag Remainer nows.
Yeah, also potentially, you're talking about people that did vote Leave but have changed their mind since.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Such as Sarah Wollaston, actually. She was a Eurosceptic before the vote.
Mm.
So this is the former Tory MP who's
who is now a Liberal Democrat. Oh, we're yes. very happy to have her.
We should probably move on to Hong Kong, but do you think it's right that Sarah Wollaston stood as a Tory and now she's actually changed sides? She wasn't Change UK and now she's a Lib Dem. Do you think it's right that she's been able to cross the floor without calling a by-election, particularly given that she apparently sponsored a bill that would have mandated MPs to hold by-elections when they actually change party?
I don't know. I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy on her part there. But also, it's within the rules that we have, and it should be at the discretion of each member of parliament. Can you imagine her constituents having to go to the polls like three times in the past like 3 years? That would have been very silly. I think also it complicates things for kind of like the ability for you to be an independent MP as well. I don't know.
Well, if you're elected as an independent MP, you can remain as an independent MP. But I mean, you said before on this podcast, you don't really buy into the idea that many MPs have a personal mandate. So most MPs are elected because they stand on a particular party ticket. People are voting for the party rather than the MP. So it does. I mean, it seems wrong to me that you can actually change from being a Tory to being a Lib Dem, particularly given those different parties' stance on Brexit, which is, you know, the Tories
yeah,
wanted to
but
implement
it's,
results,
but especially,
the Lib Dems wanted to ignore it.
But especially now, there are so many members of Parliament who differ from the party line, like the party whip, whether it be Jeremy Corbyn or along the line of Brexit or whatever. And so it would, I mean, even like some of the like there's some like right wing loonies who don't agree with their actual party manifesto, who keep on being voted in again and again and again. And so you have to. I'm like, there is a certain amount of a personal mandate that an individual gets, even though I don't think it is like the main reason that most people vote for them. I don't know. I don't really care too much about it. I think it should be down to the MP whether or not they resign.
Interesting.
I don't
know. About Hong Kong.
Yes, sure. I know everything. You should ask me the questions.
Have you been to Hong Kong before?
Yes, several times.
Several times.
Yes.
I
have a very, very impressive passport, Jimmy.
I mean, it'll be a beautiful blue passport when you come to renew it, won't it?
Mm-hmm. Go die.
What's Hong Kong like, then? How does it actually compare to China? Mainland China, I should say.
It's night and day. They are very different places. Like, and I think that difference is especially with kind of like a lot of the southern Guangzhou province of China that borders Hong Kong. I think that is like slowly changing a lot. There is slowly becoming a lot more prosperity, but Hong Kong was kind of kept isolated from the rest of China for such a long time. They have a different official language. They speak Cantonese there, whereas in Hong Kong, on mainland China, they speak Mandarin. They use a different writing system. It's very similar, but it's a slightly different writing system. system. They have English plugs, so they have the three-pronged plugs. They drive on the left. They have a very distinct kind of like cinematography and culture, like their own movie industry, and like their own kind of like architectural style. It's a very, very different place. But that is slowly changing as China tries to kind of like integrate Hong Kong into the rest of the People's Republic.
Well, I don't think you mentioned it in the introduction, but the plan when Hong Kong was handed back to the Chinese was that it would be run one country, two systems. So Hong Kong would be run in a different way from mainland China. But eventually the plan is to actually fully integrate the two territories, isn't it?
Yeah, 2046 is the final year of one country, two systems.
And then after that, Hong Kong will just be run the same as anywhere else in China.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. But then also part of the handover agreement was that Hong Kong was going to become fully democratic by, I think it was 2017. And that was scuppered because the chief executive of Hong Kong, it's very funny in Hong Kong because they call all of their like leaders, it's like it's a bank.
appropriately enough.
Yeah, really. Appropriately. But they said, Hong Kong's not ready for full democracy yet. They can't be trusted. And those were the first, what were called the Yellow Umbrella Revolution, which was in 2014-15, and kind of sparked similar protests in places like Taiwan in around the same time. These particular protests that we're talking about now, where there has been violence on both sides, so like there's been violence by protesters, but also a huge amount of violence from the Hong Kongese police, who it's been so problematic that the UK has actually stopped selling tear gas to Hong Kong because of the manner in which it's being used to suppress the protests.
It seems slightly bad that we ever did sell tear gas to Hong Kong.
You know, we love exporting weapons of war. It's one of the things we do really, really well.
As opposed to weapons of peace, obviously.
Yes, of course. Obviously.
Yeah.
But there was, on the anniversary of the handover, which I believe is the 20th of June or July or something like that, they stormed Parliament, an occupied Parliament, and there's been kind of like, and all of this wave of protests has been because of this extradition bill, which is brought forward by Carrie Lam, who is the chief executive.
It has been shelved now though, hasn't it? They're not actually going to implement it, at least in the immediate future.
So this is the thing. It's not been, there is a certain terminology, and I cannot remember the actual terminology, I should have looked this up, but there is a certain terminology that Lam would have to use in order for it to be completely withdrawn and cancelled. At the moment, it's in a state of suspension, and so would be able to still be revived relatively easily, whereas there is specific terminology, and I don't know what it is, I think it's like withdraw. She has never said that she is going to withdraw the bill. She was asked by the BBC a couple of days ago whether or not she had the autonomy, independent of the Communist Party, independent of Beijing, to be able to withdraw the bill if she so wished. And she dodged that question and didn't answer it. So we can all assume she doesn't have the autonomy to be able to do that. And it's these protests, they're having a financial impact on Hong Kong, the island. The protests were able to stop planes from being able to take off efficiently from Hong Kong International Airport for like a good couple of days. The finance minister has released an emergency budget to kind of try and mitigate for the circumstances. And you're really seeing kind of like, I mean, there's a generation of Hong Kongese who are kind of like maybe around our age, who were kind of raised with, who came of age just off of the back of being returned to China in 1997. and were promised all of these things, these legacies from their Britishness. So were promised the ability to be able to partake in democracy. They had a very British education system, at least back then. And that is now all being kind of like denied and taken away from them. And so there is, I do feel this desperation from kind of like a lot of Hong Kongese people and people who live there that I know, of kind of like, but also there is only one way that this goes. And the way that this goes is that it's the CPP, the Communist Party, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, who hold the cards, who hold the deck, and who are going to decide the future of Hong Kong no matter what.
There's actually been a lot of troops and military vehicles seen massing in, is it Shenzhen, is that how you pronounce
Shenzhen,
it?
Shenzhen, yeah.
Right, and the assumption is that at some point soon, if the protests don't abate, then the Chinese government will actually send those troops in. The Chinese ambassador to the UK, apparently he's been in post for like 10 years or something, and this is only his second public statement. So this is quite a big deal. He said, if the situation deteriorates into uncontrollable unrest, the central government will not sit by and watch. We have enough power to quell the unrest. Which I think is a fairly direct threat as things go. Mm. And he also in that same appearance before the press, he warned the UK not to poke its nose into Hong Kong's affairs.
What they see is internal affairs. Whereas actually the UK still does have obligations to Hong Kong until the completed handover in 2046. So
what are those obligations exactly?
They're vague. And I can't remember what the wording is, but it is vague. It's basically if the UK wants to intervene, then it probably would be able to make an international law grounds that it would be able to. But does the UK want to start a war with China? Probably not, because as you said, Jimmy, Brexit is the most important thing on the planet right now.
I mean, people have... Every time anything has come up kind of in the international arena, people have said, oh, Britain could be dealing with this if it wasn't for Brexit. But realistically speaking, we wouldn't be in that much of a better position to do anything about this if, you know, certainly from a military point of view, even if Brexit wasn't happening.
It was right? One of the things that actually made me quite respect Jeremy Hunt when he was Foreign Secretary. He, obviously didn't threaten China at all, but was critical of them quite firmly. And I just have a feeling that Dominic Raab is not going to take a similar stance as Foreign Secretary, because I think he's a bit distracted by the snap election that's going to be called. But there is kind of like a feeling that we have abandoned them, partially this is like we only started rolling out democracy in Hong Kong when we realised that there was absolutely no way of us being able to hold on to it past 1997 at the end of the lease. And that's a bit douchey. And then when we did give them some kind of democracy that existed before 97, it didn't... it wasn't like proper democracy. It wasn't properly kind of like the people decide how stuff is run, because it was such an important kind of like international financial hub. And so there were fears of if you give universal suffrage to everybody in Hong Kong, then that lucrative identity of Hong Kong as kind of like this safe haven in the southeast of Asia for financial services would be under threat. Imagine that, a vote of the people putting financial services under threat. I wonder what that would feel like.
Do these people have no shame putting dear financial services under threat?
I know, could you imagine? Although, to be fair, it is like all of the island's economy, but anyway.
A number of people, and particularly Tom Tugendhat, the MP, who apparently is chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee.
What a great
the prospect
name.
It is a good name.
Tugendhat.
He's raised the prospect that Britain could offer citizenship to Hong Kong citizens. Partly is just a something to protect them and allow them to come over to the UK and be safer than they would be in Hong Kong, but also as actually a means of applying pressure to China, because if you do this, it actually did, you know, in theory it would deter the Chinese government from cracking down so harshly on protesters, because they'd have an incentive not to do so. What do you make of this as a proposal?
Good luck. In a country where we are so averse to any kind of liberalisation or special cases or increasing just the numbers, not even thinking about the human beings, just the numbers of people who come to the United Kingdom, good luck being able to pass that, past Priti Patel. Christ. There are 7 million people in Hong Kong. Probably a lot more, actually, to be completely honest. And we, one of the things that we kind of like fell down was we never actually gave Hong Kongese people the ability to apply for citizenship, even when they were being returned to communist China. And this was like when we were, like it was when the country started opening up under Deng Xiaoping, but it was when. Like, even under those circumstances, in the face of the Cold War, and even post-Cold War, we still wouldn't give citizenship to Hong Kongese people. And, like, there's many reasons why. Probably kind of a lot of it's to do with racism and colonialism and those kinds of attitudes. But I find that I would love it if we would do that, but good luck.
See, you know, I get what you're saying about the history of, you know, British attitudes to giving citizenships to former, you know, former colonial subjects. But Boris, you know, one thing that you can say in favour of Boris Johnson is that he is actually quite, he's genuinely pro-immigration. He's quite social liberal more generally. I wouldn't have expected Theresa May to do something like this, but I wouldn't be that surprised if Boris Johnson did look into that, into giving citizenship to Hong Kongers more seriously. It does seem like the sort of thing that he would do. And there is precedent in the case of, I'm trying to remember which country it was. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It was people fleeing Idi Amin's regime. Does that ring any bells?
No.
Am I going to have to... Uganda, I think it was. I'm sure it was Uganda, because actually Patel is of Ugandan heritage. And we offered, when they were being persecuted by Idi Amin, we actually did offer citizenship to, I think it was tens of thousands of the people being persecuted.
Tens of thousands versus 7 million is a bit of a stretch.
That is true, but I think it could be possible. Even the Sun has actually backed it, and the Sun is not the most notably pro-immigration newspaper in the UK.
How interesting. I would love it if we could do that. Hong Kong is a part of the world that I really love. Like, I lived in, for any listeners who don't know, I lived in China for 2 years. I lived in Nanjing, but was in and out of Hong Kong like an awful lot, and know people there and really love the place. And it's really quite sad to see a city that is so dynamic and has given the world so much in terms of culture and personality and food, such good food. It's really quite depressing to see it be trodden over like this, and for there to not really be any kind of possible resolution other than kind of like the inevitability of Communist Party rule. Should we even talk about the fact that Donald Trump waded in?
What did Donald say about this whole thing?
Don't call him Donald. he said that he did a couple of tweets a couple of days ago. If President Xi would meet directly and personally with the protesters, there would be a happy and enlightened ending to the Hong Kong problem. I have no doubt. And he said, I know President Xi of China very well. He is a great leader who very much has the respect of his people. He is also a good man in a tough business. I have a zero doubt that if President Xi wants to quickly and humanely solve the Hong Kong problem, he can do it. Personal meeting? And nobody's really sure whether he meant a personal meeting between him and Xi, or a personal meeting between President Xi and the protesters.
It's one of the better things that Donald Trump has said, I think. Even if it is quite impractical. But, you know, he's trying to flatter Xi Jinping to get him to deal with the protesters more humanely. That seems actually oddly diplomatic for Donald Trump.
Oddly diplomatic. But he also wants to buy Greenland, so.
Ah, oh, God, I can't believe that we didn't moot by Greenland as a topic.
too much just, research. Too... I don't want to go... I know the history of Greenland is very complicated, and I don't want to read that Wikipedia article.
Yeah, I mean, okay, just a little fact, but apparently after the Second World War, the US actually tried to buy Greenland off of Denmark. Greenland is still legally part of Denmark, though it's run fairly autonomously. Mm-hmm. And the Danish said no. I think this time round the Greenlanders probably would have their own opinions about things and would not be in favour, I don't think. They're actually trying to become more independent of Denmark at the moment because they're currently reliant on them for subsidies and that sort of thing. It's interesting. America has a history of just buying huge swathes of territory. So it's,
see Alaska.
Alaska, Louisiana Territory, which is sort of most of the center of continental US. So, it's a very American way of dealing things.
Mm-hmm.
Should we talk about Greta Thunberg?
Well, if you so like. The Green Party MP, who has managed to be across... No, not all. She wasn't in Hong Kong. Who's had a lot of mentions this episode. If you fancy Caroline, come on the podcast. We're a big fan. She has officially complained to Twitter.
You're a big fan.
Big fan, Caroline.
I think she might divide the room a little bit if she came on.
Yeah. Well, Caroline, we're going to call her Caroline because she's our mate now, has complained to Twitter over a tweet by the, what is he?
He's a businessman, Aaron Banks. I'm not sure what business he's involved in.
Okay.
He used to run call centres because there was some controversy about sort of data from people involved in his business and like the EU campaign. I can't remember it all that well. Anyway, he's some sort of businessman. He makes money somehow.
So she has complained about a tweet that he did where he said, what was it he said? Oh, yeah.
He said, freak yachting accidents do happen in August. And it was a retweet comment over a picture of Greta Thunberg in a boat.
Yeah, so Greta Thunberg has managed to head the potential critics of her travelling internationally off at the pass, because very often you end up with these green campaigners flying to all of the... Like, it is important to have to go to these events and go to these places so that you can meet individuals and have the ears of the mighty and powerful. But then they're like, well, if you cared so much about the environment, then why did you fly here? Blah, 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 blah. And Greta Thunberg went, yeah, bitches, I'm sailing. So she's sailing across the Atlantic on... a massive yacht, but a yacht nonetheless. She's described it as she's now currently on, I believe, day four of her trip, and she said that it was like camping on a roller coaster, and she's not got seasickness yet. How can you hate her? She's so cute.
Camping on a roller coaster doesn't sound good, I've got to say.
Yeah, it does sound like quite
those seem like a negative combination, I think.
Mm-hmm. Aaron Banks basically was like, hope she dies.
Yep, that is basically what happened.
What is it about... And also, like, there were other people, let's just name names, Tom Harwood, tweeted about the fact that there were a load of motorboats media on motorboats following her ship out to sea to cover it and be like, oh, she sails out, but look at all of these like diesel boats that are surrounding her. It's like, she didn't cover the logistics of the journalists, did she? Obviously.
A fair rejoinder to that, though, which is that it wasn't actually necessary for her to publicise her decision to sail. She could have done it retrospectively.
No, but that's kind of like the whole point of her job.
Yeah, but it's a publicity stunt. I think you saying, oh, but you know, she doesn't control the journalists, but it was entirely predictable that journalists would actually come out and cover it.
Yes.
And she presumably wanted that to happen and help facilitate that happen. So I think Tom Harwood's criticism is correct in this instance.
I completely disagree. What the hell is wrong with you? She didn't decide that they would rent speedboats.
Well, they needed somebody to reach her.
Yeah, so... why didn't they use, like, a little dinghy? Like a mirror dinghy or a laser?
Because journalists are busy people. We've got...
Greta Thunberg's bloody busy. She's been invited to the UN.
Well, she didn't have to take a two-week cruise in order to get there.
A two-week cruise. My God.
It is taking 2 weeks to get there.
This is something I would I'm curious to ask you. What is it about Greta Thunberg that infuriates people so much?
Are you asking me because you think I'm infuriated by her?
I'm leaving this open to interpretation.
Is that the... I sort of don't give a shit about her one way or the other. But you're right, she does annoy a lot of right-wing Brexiteers, frankly. There does seem to be a significant overlap between voting for Brexit and being annoyed by Greta Thunberg.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's... I mean, there is something a bit annoying about her, I think, and the way she's kind of been raised.
Yeah, it's because she's self-righteous and right.
I guess she is quite self-righteous and but I mean there is a question of like why do people keep chatting to her, because her whole point is, oh, you should be listening to the scientists, and it's like, okay, well, why don't we just go chat to some scientists then?
Nobody is actually talking to the scientists, so they go and talk to her.
Well, I think that's untrue, actually, is that actually the British government is doing a fair bit to attempt at least to combat climate change. There's quite a lot of initiatives in the works. And, you know, you can criticise how effective those initiatives are, whether we're doing enough and all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But the idea that nothing is being done by Western governments is just wrong. And I don't think that's something that she said specifically, but that is something that people like the Extinction Rebellion have said.
Mm-hmm.
That they are overhyping things a little bit, I think it's fair to say. I think you're more a fan of her than I am. You must have found the way that like Michael Gove and co like grovelled in front of her very, very sickly, I think. You know, there was something quite demeaning about that whole spectacle from the British public's point of view.
Yes. But I don't know how else you can... How else can you interact with a... She is still a child. She's older than she looks. She is 16, but she looks she looks younger. She looks like 13.
She does, yeah.
Which I think plays into her hand. How can you be anything other than respectful, silent, and listening to a young girl who asks you... Who is... She's never... angry, she never like shouts, she's very measured, and she herself has talked about how her autism kind of like helps her to react in that kind of a way, like she is kind of like the polar opposite of what people would imagine as kind of like a shouty protester, and it's very, I don't know, I think that she's so disarming that they just get furious about it, because there's nothing that they can do. There's nothing that they can engage with her in the way that they usually would by using kind of like that kind of rhetoric. Whereas her like way of communicating is so left of field for the way that our media is set up that they just don't know how to deal with it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. Do you think there is something a bit cynical in how she's being deployed? And kind of built upon by people who are interested, well, people who are campaigning against climate change. Do you think there's an element of cynicism there?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, there's cynicism in any kind of marketing campaign, and she is a part of a marketing campaign. But she is a genuine kind of like grassroots activist. She's one of the kids who started the mass school protests and walkouts. So her involvement is genuine, and obviously there is a machine around her that is always going to feel gross. Marketing is gross. But I don't doubt her sincerity, and I think she's. I'd shake her hand probably. I think she's pretty amazing.
Ah, there you go. I don't think I'm as impressed as you are, but
yeah, yeah. But you hate the environment, and you don't want our children to have a future.
Man, I recycle so much. Maybe I should stop buying so many things that I need to recycle, though.
Yeah, so
that could be used against me.
Reduce, reuse, recycle, my friend.
Yeah. The joke aspect of this. So Aaron Banks said, you know, I mean, I think it was a joke. You can argue whether it was funny or not, but I don't think he actually wants Greta Thunberg to die. I think that's quite unlikely. Okay. And he has claimed it was a joke subsequently. But in that way, isn't it a bit churlish of Caroline Lucas to have like lodged a complaint against him through Twitter?
Yes.
Is there maybe a broader argument that, you know, politicians from both the left and the right, because obviously there was that Joe Brand acid attack joke that a lot of the right, you know, people
you mentioned earlier that Victoria Coren Mitchell noted that Aaron Banks complained quite harshly about the Joe Brand acid attack.
So Aaron Banks said he actually said this to Victoria Coren Mitchell directly via Twitter. He said a funny comment. This is commenting on the Joe Brand joke. He said a funny comment is comparing a woman wearing a burqa to a letterbox, referencing presumably Boris Johnson's infamous column to that effect. Continuing the quote, not suggesting throwing acid over someone. So Aaron Banks is in this tweet suggesting that you can't joke about throwing acid over someone, which is untrue, I think, fundamentally. But there's definite hypocrisy going on here, I think.
Shock, horror, colour me. What are you meant to say with colour me? I don't know. But shock, horror, Aaron Banks, hypocrisy.
Yeah, I think that people just need to accept that bad, you know, jokes in bad taste are obviously jokes. I mean, this is obviously a joke, and I think can we stop reporting people for making jokes, even if you think they're crass or in terrible taste? Can we have this as a new norm? Would that be all right?
Is that what you're going to start campaigning on?
Stop reporting bad jokes.
Yeah, stop reporting just people being dicks on Twitter. People are allowed to be dicks. I don't know. I think his tweet was clearly not actually a death threat. I was joking that he threatened to kill her with weather. But I don't think that is the case.
I like this idea that Aaron Banks has gone into his garden and is doing a little rain dance in the back. Just hoping that across the Atlantic Ocean,
a hurricane
a
builds.
Downpour.
Yeah,
yeah.
I feel like people should be allowed to say unpleasant things.
Yeah.
He didn't threaten to kill her. He's just a twat. Let him be a twat.
Since you raised this, and I think we can wrap up after this, but you said earlier that you think that right-wing people are just less funny than left-wing people.
Yes.
Do you want to justify that statement?
Not really.
Do you want to leave that as a comment?
Yeah, we'll leave that on the record. That's fine. I'll stand by it, but I don't want to justify it.
You don't want to justify it? Because there is that whole argument that because, you know, right-wingers tend to be... I think this is fair. This might piss off a sexual audience, but I think they're slightly less concerned or less sympathetic towards the downtrodden elements in society, and therefore they're more willing to punch down, as the phrase goes.
Yes, I think that would be part of my argument. Yeah,
that's part of your argument.
I just don't think it is. There is the whole idea in comedy where you can punch sideways and up. So people who are who are like you and people who are more privileged than you, but you probably shouldn't punch down because that just looks a bit shit. I don't think there's any like subversion there. That's just like you reinforcing the shit stuff in society. I don't think it's funny. It's just you going,
So I was listening to a podcast. This was either Trigonometry or it might have been the Jeff Norcott podcast. This is laying an insight into what sort of podcasts I listen to. Probably not a very surprising one. But Simon Evans, this right-wing comedian, made the argument that actually in a stand-up comedy routine, what is a lot of the humour can be generated from actually, you know, ever shifting sort of positions of status. And what he's effectively saying is that at some points in his routine, he'll be sort of punching downwards on someone because he'll be acting as though he's high status and then they're low status. But then he'll make a self-deprecating comment and sort of invert the relationship between who is high status and low status. And he thinks that a lot of humour is actually generated over the course of a stand-up routine, over the shift between him and the audience. And
I think there's probably some correct stuff with that, but it, like, at its core, it is still based on kind of like dynamics of social status and like somehow the subversion of them, whether or not it's in like a one line joke or a single tweet or over like a whole over like a whole routine. If it's still subverted, like, it's just like, finding somebody funny differs from person to person. I just don't find it very funny when people punch down. I think it's just, I just don't find it funny.
See, I think it can be very funny, but this probably speaks. Yeah, I mean, do you think that you just don't find right-wingers funny because you're not right-wing, at least on a social level?
Ask all of my Labour friends. Apparently I am right-wing, Jimmy.
I mean, I don't want to constantly bring it back to our favourite person, but do you think Tom Harwood would share your view on the nature of comedy and punching down?
I don't know. Tom, open invitation.
It's an invitation. Okay.
Just to talk about comedy. Nothing in the news. Just to talk about comedy.
Are we happy to wrap this up now? Yes. Have you said everything that you want to say?
Will I have ever fully unburdened myself? Probably not, which is why we're on 140 episodes.
We are, I think.
Yeah, we are. This is episode 140.
140. Where can they find you on Twitter, Jazza, if they want to make some jokes punching down at your low status?
See, that's funny. You can find me at Jazza John, not only on Twitter, but across all social platforms.
Brilliant. You can find me at JDE Nichols, only on Twitter. I'm not cool enough to have an Instagram account, so they won't let me. It's very sad.
I love the idea that you applied and they rejected you.
As in so many areas of life. Mm-hmm. You can also tweet the podcast more generally at Right Dishonour. You can go to rightdishonourable.com. I haven't posted anything there for a while, but it will occasionally happen. And you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable if you want to throw us some money. That's the only channel, actually, at the moment by which you can do that. Should we leave it there, Jazza?
Yes. Feel free to throw money at us, like, in the street as well. Not mad about it.
Not coins.
No, preferably. cash only. Notes.
Tough to throw notes, though.
It is. Paper aeroplanes.
Sort of just waft.
Let's go. This is falling apart. Okay, bye.
Let's go. Bye.